Okay, so my name is Rastko Sknepnik. I'm at the University of Dundee, and I'm a physicist, but a lot of my time is spent on actually doing computation and actually developing the code. And so this is not going to be a physics talk. This is going to be a hardware slash software talk about a very special technology which is emerging called GPU, Graphic Processing Unit. And let me start from where it comes from, right? So this in here would be a highly complicated real-time simulation of a complicated mechanical system, right? Also known as video game. So what goes into producing something like this, right? So if you look at the standard nowadays modern TVs and modern monitors, typically they have of the order of 2,000 pixels horizontally versus 1,000 pixel vertically, which gives you around 2 million pixels. In order to get feeling of that this is of motion, you need to update the picture roughly 60 times a second, so 60 same frames a second. And in order to actually get the all the mechanics and all the lighting and all the texturing, you need roughly 10 to the 4 operations per pixel, right, to generate something like this. So if you multiply this through, you get something like 10 to the 12 or a trillion operations per second, right? So in order to get this, in order to be able to crash your car for $60 instead of $60,000, right, you need to pay 1 trillion operations every second, right? So, and if you know a little bit about the development of the CPU technology, you know that CPU cannot do this. You need a special device which is going to be able to deliver you this speed. And now the question is, okay, this is very nice, but can we use these type of devices to do something useful, meaning on a computational side? Yes, and that's the topic of this talk. So I'm going to condense it. I'm going to talk about these devices. They are roughly maybe like a foot long, called the GPUs or graphic processing units. And briefly, I'm going to tell them how they are different. I'm going to tell you how they are different from typical CPUs and how they internally work and why is it so convenient for certain types of computational problems. So let's first look into CPU. So CPU is, some people would call it the heart or the brain of the computer. So typically, if you open your desktop, there will be a cooler. You remove the cooler, you're going to see thing which is maybe this size. This is a CPU. And when you're designing a CPU, you cannot make much assumptions about what it's going to run, right? People are going to use computers to check their Facebook. Some people are going to run fluid dynamics. They're going to do their taxes, right? So when you're designing a CPU, you have to make it able to do, easily programmable, and to do a lot of very different things efficient, right? So which means you have to have a device which is good at doing everything, but not excellent in doing any single particular thing, right? And that's the way to do it, right? You know, otherwise you're going to have a specialized hardware, right? The other option is that if you have very specific tasks, like for example graphics, that you offload a certain type of tasks, then if you have a very specific task, then you can make a very strong assumptions about what kind of data structures you're going to be working on, what algorithms you're going to want to work. So you can actually now try to optimize your device. So you can actually try to make a device which is going to be really, really good in doing certain type of tasks, but not really good in doing Facebook, for example, right? And one of the examples is a graphic processor, right? So graphics is a very peculiar thing which you can make a very strong assumptions about how it's done in order to accelerate its execution on the graphics. And for example, one of the things is, like, you know, on my screen, I know exactly what my neighboring pixels are. Pixels are not flowing on the screen, so I can make very strong assumptions about the things like this, right? So if we, and that was all very nice, right? So the idea to actually use specialized hardware to graphics emerged maybe in the 80s. Then there was a big breakthrough in the mid 90s when people started realizing they can use them to do 3D graphics, to shoot aliens in 3D, right? And that was all very nice, but not very interesting from a scientific point of view until 2006, where NVIDIA Corporation, one of the two major players in the field, decided to open the interface, to open the hardware to non-graphic related computing. So they essentially said, like, okay, now you can actually access this device. We are going to give you specification, we're giving you interface, we're going to give you proper compilers and proper tools to deal with this. And, you know, here you go. You can actually, if you can use this device to do something else, then do it, right? And that's how what is called GPU was born, or general purpose GPU computing, graphic processing computing was born, right? And then if you are to compare, so now the So why I'm talking about these things in here, right? There are two comparisons between processors and graphics processors, GPUs, right? And this is a processor. This is a comparison in terms of the flops, number of floating point of operation this device can do. And you can see that there is almost an order of magnitude larger number of floating point operations a graphic processor can do. And the other comparison, which is very important for scientific computation, is the bandwidth, meaning how much data you can put onto this processor in order for it to do something. And you see that these devices are beating even the top-notch CPUs by orders of magnitude in speed. So how it is done? It's done by radically different architecture inside. So if you compare two flagships, this is the flagship CPU of Intel Corporation, this is the flagship GPU. What I want to point is the number of cores, right? So typically nowadays you can buy 16-core processor and that's about it, right? And these guys have like of the order of 3,000 cores. And another really striking thing is the difference in the bandwidth, in the amount of data you can actually send to the processor to actually process at the given point in time, right? So if you look briefly under the hood, again, there is a very, very striking difference in how the entire thing is organized. CPU has a small number of relatively complicated cores, and a lot of silicon, a lot of electronics is spent in actually implementing clever algorithms to do so-called caching, to actually get the data from the memory so that the processor can do something while memory is waiting for what is called the latency, on its latency, right? On the other side, GPU is constructed with having thousands of cores and being able to actually do a large number of computations at the expense of much simpler logic when it comes to accessing the memory. So this is a little bit of jargon at the moment, but it's going to become clear when I give you an example where it comes from. So how can we use this? So this is all very nice, but how can we use it to do something useful in terms of computational physics? So let's like try to do the Drosophila of computational physics, and that's the addition of two. Yeah.
Also.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So this is the. So you wanna sooner or later go to some linear algebra, right? So you wanna add two vectors. Let's say A and B. They are already prepared in memory, and we wanna add them to vector C, right? And then how it's done? You just add them up, and then you move the window, add them up right in the memory slot C, and so on and so on. And if you look into a code, this is how it would look like, right? You would have a loop which would just loop over I 1, 2, 3, 4, 2 million or billion or whatever and just write it in C. But how about if you were able to do something like this, right? So if you were able to do something like this so if I were able to actually take all of them in the same time and just say like I add them all up and suddenly, right, that would be tremendous increase in speed. And actually this is possible with these devices. Using essentially this programming model which was called CUDA programming, where the part of the actual addition is now living on the graphic card and it's just called from a processor. So now what is interesting in here is that there is no more loop, right? So if you look into this, the upper part is now going to be working on the graphic card, the lower part is going to be working on the host, and there is no loop. So instead, what we have, we have that each of small units in the CPU, in the GPU, in the graphic processor, acts on one element simultaneously with everyone else, right? So what we do, we just feed these two big arrays to the graphic card, and then the graphic card fires up its thousands of cores, right? And each of them actually acts on one of the elements. I'm simplifying things a little bit more complicated than this, but that's the idea, right? So each of them fires up its own core, and each of these cores work on a single element, and kind of like in parallel adds them up, and then does its magic, sends it back out, right? So this is clearly different concept in programming, and the nice thing why is this actually useful is that the interface is very similar to what most of us are familiar with, which is a regular C language, right? This is, I think, something which is standard, with the exception of these couple of these green lighty things, which are additional commands which were introduced in order to allow us to, you know, to interface with the graphic card, right? So so what happens actually inside, if you look under the hood, is that each of the, so the processor, the GPU, has these what are called streaming multiprocessors, and then each of these guys, so it's kind of a hierarchical structure. So each of these guys has a ton, very, very large number of small cores, which are much simpler than cores of a regular CPU, but they're really, really kind of focused on, so most of the transistors are actually focused on doing number crunching, on adding numbers, right? And all this gibberish in here essentially is a huge highway which allows them to be busy, right? So what happens, you feed a huge amount of data in all of them and they just kind of trickle through this in parallel and are then sent out to the output. So that's a very, very different concept in computing. Okay. So of course that comes with, you know, so you have to kind of somehow organize your data in order to be able to use them properly. And so everything is again structured hierarchically. So the basic unit of computation is so-called thread. So that would be the small snippet of the program which actually does something on a single number or on a single unit. And it has a very fast access to its local memory. And then these guys are actually, these threads are clumped together in what is called a thread block. This is a logical unit where they can talk to each other closely. And then these thread blocks are made in a bigger structure called the grid. And then the grids can be more grids, right? So in that way, one can actually use the fact that not all the devices have the same amount of memory and same amount of processor, because in this way, like different, so you can generate these grids depending on the size of what actual hardware you are using, and reuse your code appropriately, right? And in this particular case, right, in the case of our example of adding two vectors, this would be a single thread. This would be a single line, right? Single wiggly line. And then these guys would then generate a block of n copies of such lines, right? Okay, and now this is another very important thing, and it's what is called the latency hiding. The CPU itself, so essentially not all the components of a computer work at the same speed, right? So processor is a very fast entity, and memory is rather slow. So it's not very useful to have a Ferrari engine on a small Fiat F500, right? You're not going to get very far, right? So you have to actually somehow keep this processor busy. You have to feed enough data to this processor so that it can actually run its course, and that's why a lot of effort is done in what is called the caching, right? So you have a different levels of smaller amount of temporary memory, which is close to the processor, which is very fast, and then very intelligent logics, which actually copies bigger chunks of data into these smaller chunks and keeps the processor busy, therefore hiding latency of stuff which is far away in a slowly accessible memory. But whenever, occasionally, you actually hit the idle times of your processor, right? And the point of a processor design is to make these idle times as small as possible by intelligently designing these type of caches, right? On the other hand, on GPU, you have a completely different approach. You don't have caches, but what you have a huge number of processes running in parallel. And if one of them gets stuck, if one of them says like, okay, I don't have anything to do, I don't have enough data to work on, I'm waiting for something to arrive from memory, right? Then what the GPU says like, okay, it says like, doesn't matter, I'm just going to put you to sleep until you get your own data, and I'm going to wake up someone else, right? So, for example, W4 starts running, and he's like, okay, now I need the data, and then GPU says like, okay, I'm going to put you to sleep, and I'm just going to get W3 to run, right? And it runs its course, so this is the time goes this way, right? So, and that's what is called a very fast context switching, right? Where you are jumping from one process to another, and whenever one of them gets stuck. So if you just now look this way, you get a continuous utilization of the device, right? Because while those, so there is always someone doing something while other guys are sleeping, right? And there is some logic which does this automatically behind the, yes?
But since you have so many of these codes, you could do that multiple of things happening at the same time.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly the, I'll get back to that, you know. Of course, you know, this is an ideal picture, it's not, yeah. But the drawback of this approach is in order to have this, this to actually work, to be useful, you have to run thousands of threads. You need a huge problem. You need kind of like a lot of data to work with, right? You're not gonna gain much if you just wanna try to add two vectors that are long 100 elements, right? So when it comes to the programming model, so how these devices are, this is your CPU, this is your regular memory, this is your graphic card, right? So what you do when you program these devices, you first populate the memory in your regular computer, then you transfer it onto the graphic card memory. Then you load the program from the regular CPU memory onto the device, right? So now device has its own memory, has its own program, so now it's ready, good to go, right? You press enter. Device, you know, it starts lighting, right? You get your stuff done, and then when you're done, you copy this for post-processing, right? So if you are to look into the programming model of these devices, you have chunks which are serial and chunks which are parallel, right? So you prepare your data, and then you say, like, okay, so I do something, I prepare my matrices, then I kind of fire up GPU, then they do its magic, the multiply matrices, do some fancy stuff, right? And then I'm done, then I collect this, do something with it, fire it up again, and you can do this as many times as you want, right? So let me briefly go through this. So this is the actual code. If you were to run this, this would actually run. The main thing to notice is that you actually have to mirror everything, right? So you have to have a data defined on the processor, and you have to data defined on the GPU, on the graphic card, which means that everything has to. So normally, if you were to do this on a processor, you would not need these lines. So you just allocate memories for X and Y, and you would just do the calculation, then you would print out the results. And in here, you have to allocate the memory on the processor and allocate the memory on the graphic card. You have to copy data. That's the second step. You have to copy stuff onto the graphic card. Then you fire up the graphic card. That's where the magic happens. This is where the graphic card is now working. Processor is sleeping or does something else, right? And then once when you're done, you copy data back to the host. And in this case, you just calculate how good your ability is to add million ones and million twos, right? That's the idea, right?
What size of the vectors do you have then? For what size is it advantageous?
Well, typically, like, again, depends on which graphic card you use, but, you know, you want to be in like hundreds of thousands to millions, right? So you want this, you know.
The copying part is not important.
Yes, yeah. So you want to keep your graphic card as busy as possible, right? So. And that's exactly this is the slide, right? Where we talk about where is this useful, right? And it's useful if you have problems that require huge amount of computations and bandwidth, right? For example, fluid dynamics, right? Or molecular dynamics simulations, or things like this, right? Where you have a huge number of particles and you need a huge amount of computations to do something, right? You're not gonna use this to diagonalize 3x3 matrix for you know, like some introductory physics homework problem, right? Also, it's very important that you have predictable memory accesses, right? That your data structures are very nicely organized. Meaning, for example, like if you're solving partial differential equations, that you have like regular grids, for example, because then you exactly know who is whose neighbor, right? There's not much mess, right? And also, it's very very useful to have codes which are kind of like, you know, straightforward, that you don't have any loops, many diverging things. Like, for example, where it really doesn't work well is if you are trying to do search algorithms, if you try to work on graphs and things like that. Then it's these are much more algorithmically complicated things, and then graphic cards are not really useful. Unfortunately, and from this kind of rushed presentation, I hope I convinced you that this is a very different architecture, right? So the programming interface is very similar, but the architecture is very different. So it's not really, you know, you cannot take your code, Fortran code which you wrote in 1978 and try to recompile it and expect that it's going to be faster, right? You're probably going to, even if you manage to compile it, it's going to probably be slower. The thing is that you very often have to reprogram, or you have to even go back and redesign the code, right? You have to kind of like, the algorithms have to be retaught to be compliant with this different way of how the device works. But if you succeed, people really see speed ups up to, like, I know code which I'm working with in molecular dynamics, it typically speeds up of 120 times compared to the really top-notch CPU codes, right? Which is substantial amount of improvement, since this device costs like $500, right? You don't have to pay like $30,000-$40,000 for a GPU, for actual cluster, right? There is huge industry behind, right? So this is not something, this is here to stay, right? So there are corporations which are putting a lot of money into this, and there is growing number of libraries which is available. So a lot of these things can be used off of the shelf without actually understanding a bunch of this gibberish which I was talking about, bandwidth and so on. Right? So for example, there is, as far as I know, there is a MATLAB module which is rather efficient in.
It's quite easy to use. It's
yeah.
Yeah,
so as far as I know, in MATLAB is you just say something like GPU add matrix or something of that order, and it does its magic completely under the rug. You don't need
it. So is it possible to take MATLAB code that you wrote in 1978 and just?
Well, I doubt that you wrote the MATLAB in 1978, right? That's a good question. I don't know, right?
Yeah. I've got some MATLAB code that's like that. Yeah. There's a sort of just the normal version, a parallel version. Different kind of functions you use. So I think it's quite easy.
And I think MATLAB for a long time has been using this paradigm anyway of going away from loops and vectorizing all your code anyway. So I think they just have to sort of plug it into the GPU.
It wouldn't be super fast, but it's certainly quicker.
So in to briefly conclude, right? So these are very powerful devices. Right? Clearly, you know, you at the $500 or $1,000, you get a supercomputer at your desktop, right? But they are not silver bullets, right? It's clearly, they are not easy to program. Well, some people would disagree, but you know, not. And again, they are not, certain things like fluid dynamics, for example, molecular dynamics can be very, very efficiently parallelized and put on these graphic cards. On the other hand, to this date, I haven't seen a very efficient implementation of Monte Carlo. Also. Yes, but that's, you can talk about you know, they made quite a few assumptions in that, right? When it comes to molecular dynamics, it's really beautiful, right? Yeah. I know Josh was involved in this, Josh Anderson, right? And I'm familiar with the work, but it's not as clean as you can do it in molecular dynamics, right? And then also there are certain problems which are just search algorithms or sort algorithms if you're in computer science, interested in computer science, or if you have small data sets, right? Then you just, you know, it's just not useful, right? You're gonna buy a Ferrari, but you're not gonna drive it on a small road, right? It's no point. So again, there are pros and cons to this. It's a huge computational product. It's relatively easy to program, but not completely trivial. On the con side, it's actually often requires fundamental redesign of the algorithms which you are using. You still need to be fairly familiar with what is going underneath. And also because of the way how they're designed and how they're designed, there is, if you are bad programmer, is severely penalized, right? You know, it's not good to be a bad programmer, right? But in here, if you're a bad programmer, you can actually easily lose a factor of 100, right? So, thank you.
My graduate student has actually developed a finite element, the last student in this code, on the GPU. I'd be happy to show it to you.
I'd be glad to see it, yeah. That's, for example, one of the examples where you can actually really, really do a good job, right?
But we use an unstructured mesh.
But your mesh doesn't change, right? You exactly know who its neighbors are. That's,
the first step never changed, but the point is it's not a square lattice or a cubic lattice. It's just whatever the mesh program produces. But that's just one more easy data.
Yeah, but the point is the mesh is not changing, right? So you exactly know who its neighbors are, right? And then you can actually make a very strong predictions about how memory is accessed and you're probably getting 100 times speed ups, right?
It's really quite yeah. Trigger. We're working on it.
Yeah.
On that point, I mean, if you go into standard MD, your environment will change. It's somewhat less predictable, but it's clearly has been solved. So what?
Yes, that's Josh Anderson, who's in Sharon Glotz's group, right? They are very clever ways how to, he actually came up, he worked on this for quite a bit of time, right? And came up with very, very clever ways how to construct neighbor lists, right? And once then you have a neighbor list, which is a key part of molecular dynamics, then you can do magic. But I was quite involved to actually get this to work.
Yeah,